I'm Laura Palmer, host of Island Crime. Season 6, Sweethearts, is the story of three teenage girls who were all murdered in Victoria, Canada, within about 12 months.
So she was scared. Something out there scared her.
You've just created the playground where predators can really thrive.
She was a 16-year-old girl. She was a sweetheart.
Listen to Sweethearts at frequencypodcastnetwork.com or wherever you get podcasts.
Find your frequency.
When we focus on gender-based inequality in the workplace, we usually talk about money. The wage gap has been a problem ever since women began joining the workforce in large numbers. We have studied it, we've acknowledged it, companies have pledged to fix it, governments have passed laws to fix it. Nevertheless, it persists. And so the wage gap has become almost a shorthand for referring to inequality at work. That's because it's quantifiable. There are raw numbers. You can put one next to the other in a report and make a point. But the wage gap is not the only gap. Think about the last time you worked in an office. How many other workers at your level were women? Now, what about their managers? How many of them were women? And what about those managers' managers? Now you see where we're going with this. When we boil down gender imbalance in the workplace to money alone, we miss all the structural reasons that the wage gap exists. And if we can't identify the structures causing that gap, nothing is going to fix it. Not even laws. We've seen that. So where are the other gaps? How far off are we from workplace equality, really? And what do we need to get there? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Robin Doolittle is a reporter on the investigative team at the Globe and Mail. She has been working on a massive project along with a whole team. Hello, Robin.
Hi.
I want to get into the scope of your latest investigation, but just to frame it maybe before we start, can you just define the power gap? What does the term mean?
The power gap, I mean, let's like quickly back up that this started as an effort to explore the wage gap. That's what we wanted to know. We wanted to know if men and women in the same job are being paid the same rate. And we did this by collecting salary records for 90,000 public employees who earn over six figures. And when we started going through the numbers, what we found was that there was a small wage disparity that got bigger the higher up you went. But the bigger thing was just that there weren't many women. There weren't women among six-figure earners in general. There weren't women at the top, on the way to the top, in the middle, on executive teams, in all measure of management jobs. And focusing on the wage gap just didn't seem to really properly capture what we were seeing. And that's where we ultimately landed on the power gap. This is about the people and institutions who have power, who are on the way to power, whose careers are on a trajectory towards decision-making abilities.
I'm glad that you stated it that way, because my next question was going to be about pay equity and that, you know, I know there is legislation in many parts of Canada around this and has been for decades. What kind of rules govern the wage gap, but also the power gap? And where are we supposed to be if everybody was following the rules?
So the first pay equity legislation passed in Canada in the province of Ontario in 1951. As of 1951, it has been illegal to pay men and women doing the same job different wages because of their gender. It's been illegal since the 70s to allow sexism to impact promotions or firings. It's been illegal for decades to fire a woman for becoming pregnant. Like these laws are many decades old. Mm-hmm. The challenge is you know, there's all sorts of reasons you can explain why person A versus person B are being paid differently. Because, of course, experience, education, you know, in businesses where a lot is based on client relationships, like how much revenue are you generating, seniority, like all of this comes into play. And I think the big thing, though, is you can explain away these little individual cases, but when you look at the evidence on a whole, that's where you really see the overwhelming trend. So yes, it's been illegal to allow sexism and discrimination to impact wages, promotion for many decades, but it still happens. It still happens every day in this country.
Can you maybe get further into the scale of the data you were looking at? You know, when you say you're looking at the data as a whole, how much of the whole are we really seeing? I imagine only some of it is public and there's a lot that we don't have access to.
Yeah. So like I said, this started as an effort to explore the wage gap. I think we've all heard the statistic that women make something like 87 cents for every dollar that a man makes. But I think one thing that I always get frustrated by when I hear that number is it's just so broad. And it's like, what is that number? And the reality is it's the average of all women compared with all men. And it's the hourly rate. It's not even the average annual income. And I think because it's so broad, it's something that places can kind of go, oh yeah, that's rough, but kind of like brush it aside, because it's not that question that I think most women have, which is the guy at the desk next to me doing the same job as me who was in my class in university making more money? And like, that's what this really started as an effort in exploring, is are two people who are doing the same stuff with similar experience being paid the same? And the team, we were kind of discussing, like, how would we go about doing this? And the problem, of course, is that salary is secret. It's, yep. You know, people don't even like to talk about it. So how could we possibly investigate this? And then we remembered, you know, there is a huge chunk of the workforce that doesn't have secrecy around their earnings, and that is the public sector. And so most provinces have sunshine laws. So high income earners, usually it's six figures, who work at institutions that are government funded or government owned, have their name, job title, and salary published once a year. And what we did was we collected this data from every province from across the country. It took a full year to collect. Ontario publishes it in a nice little, you know, online lookup tool, but everywhere else, you almost always have to go to the individual places. We ended up focusing on four key areas that we think had the most impact on day-to-day lives of Canadians and also that shaped the country. And it also had the cleanest data and the most comparable between jurisdictions. Those are big municipal governments, core provincial governments, Crown and public corporations. So these are the places that, you know, sell liquor, handle housing, do transit, they investigate fraud, these types of big corporations that are structured like private businesses, as well as universities. And universities not only educate the next generation, but they really shape how Canadians view themselves. They pick which issues are worthy of research. They pick who gets to do that research. They distribute billions in funding for research. So this is kind of what we focused on. And it's meant to be a starting point to explore the broader workforce. And what just really stuck out again was just the lack of women. So something like, I think in the public corporations, which economists told us most likely mirrors the private sector, 76% of the six-figure earners were men. Wow. So only a quarter of the workforce to start is women. At municipalities, something like 93% of municipalities are run by a man. This is crazy when you think about this, that it's 2021. And the disparities are at all sorts of different levels in the workforce. So we divided each place up into different salary bands. So you can see how women move, the distribution of the gender divide at different levels. And that's where we really realized that one of the big takeaways is, while there's often so much focus at gender representation at the very top, the highest echelon in a workforce, women weren't making it past the middle. Like there's lots of women in the lower salary bands, but they're really, their numbers just fall off a cliff starting around like the one third of the way up or at the halfway mark.
How does that happen? I realize there's probably a million different explanations given by people who are directly impacted by this, but you know, how does that happen on such a broad scale?
This has been, so this first story that we ran really got into the data, which again, just illustrates that very few women actually make it to the top. I should note that of the women who do make it to the top, they're almost entirely white. We looked at the top 1% of earners. And I think of there's something like nearly 1,100 people in this bracket. Only 27 of them are women of color, like just for scale, like that's crazy, right? And why is that? And
that's fractional.
Yeah. So we've been exploring the reasons why in subsequent stories. And I think that there's a couple big picture things. One are all of the cultural and sociological reasons that that you probably heard about, that people are familiar with. Like one is, of course, women pay a higher tax for having children than men. There's some research that shows that women's earnings are impacted something like 20% over the course of their career once they have children, where fathers face no such dip in their earnings. There's the problem that women are penalized for being successful. People view them as less likable if they are successful. All of these traits that are revered in men, say confidence, ambition, you know, maybe some aggressiveness. If women exhibit those traits, it's negative. But unfortunately for women, those are also the traits that people expect to see in a leader. So there's all of that kind of stuff, which is those stereotypes and biases that are all baked into how we're all raised.
Right.
But the other area that I think is really important that we don't talk about enough is that we do have all of these laws on the books that prevent gender discrimination. The problem is that they're almost impossible to enforce. I spoke with many employment lawyers and experts in this area who said that it's actually cheaper for some places to break the law and pay out paltry fines or settlements than to fix the problem. And we can get into why that might be if you
yes,
want.
Please.
Okay, so the bottom line is the court system, if you're a victim of gender discrimination in the workforce, if you're not fired, you can't go to a regular court. You have to go to a human rights tribunal. So let's say you're constantly being passed over for promotion and you think it's because of your gender. And this isn't just related to gender. This could be by any measures. This could be by about race. This could be about disability. This could be about sexual orientation.
Right.
But if you feel like you're being passed over because of one of these factors that you're being discriminated against, you can complain to your HR. And if they don't do anything, like ultimately your recourse is a human rights tribunal. But the human rights tribunal system is dramatically underfunded. It takes between 2 and 4 years on average to get a hearing. The damages, if you win, and it's hard to prove discrimination cases, they're really small. They're between like $5,000 and $20,000. And even if you win, you don't get your legal fees covered. So how much of that is going to go to your lawyer? For so many people that I interviewed, they're saying this isn't worth it, basically, that being labeled a complainer is going to hurt their career much more than just kind of either suffering through it and trying to, or quitting their job and just finding somewhere else to work. Or what also happens is maybe they'll raise complaints internally, and ultimately it'll be determined that the workplace is the relationship is broken, and they're offered a settlement agreement, and they mutually part ways. And there almost always includes a confidentiality clause. So this means the issue never gets talked about. No parties can discuss it, and the problem doesn't ever get fixed.
None of that seems very satisfactory.
No, and it was interesting to me when I was speaking to people who had to sign these agreements. You know, I think most people might have become familiar with this through the Harvey Weinstein case. But I interviewed people who had this happen to them, who had settlement agreements resolving all different manners of gender discrimination complaints. So many women who were fired because they became pregnant or after they became pregnant, people who complained about the lack of promotion or pay inequities. And it all was kind of just buried under these settlement agreements that, again, the place never actually has to fix anything.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together, and we were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a six-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
So what do these governments and crown corporations say when you approach them with the data? Because to your point earlier, you know, if you came to them with somebody who was a complainant, they could argue their side of it. But how do they explain away that vast gap?
So this is an ongoing series. And, you know, the laying down the data was step one, and then exploring it has been what we're doing the last couple of weeks. And I found it's a real mix. We did go to all the different, something like 200 entities in our data set, and ask them to explain their numbers. What I found really interesting is some of the places that were the most defensive were universities. Universities have, you know, pretty poor numbers on the higher that you go, the top 10% of earners, and on the executive level. And like here's a classic thing that kept happening with universities. When we measured power, we looked at different salary bands, looked at overall numbers, and we also looked at the most senior executive levels. So these are the top people sitting at the table making the key decisions, like the president, the vice presidents. Most of the time, executives, there was between 6 and 10 kind of thing. Universities were very upset and wanted us to include, 60 people on their executive team. Because, of course, the lower that you go, the more women that you capture. So I just thought that was really interesting, that this, rather than kind of confronting the problem and saying, yes, this is the case, you're kind of getting a lot of these excuses in some ways. The other thing, I think we've had subsequent stories, the Globe was able to review very confidential compensation data at Cassels Brock, the 15th largest law firm in the country. And it showed that the wage gap among equity partners at that firm was 25%. So the male lawyers were, on average, earning $200,000 more per year than the women.
Wow.
And at the associate level, which is more junior, I didn't have the exact numbers, but what it did show was that the men were also earning more than the women, and that of the bonuses, 80% of the men were getting bonuses, and only 44% of the women were getting bonuses. And it was really interesting. So Cassels obviously was probably not thrilled at this information coming out, but they did provide really robust explanations. And one of the things was that they had made a real push to increase the number of women at the equity partner level, and that when you're just expanding the equity partner level, you're at the bottom of the grid and it takes time to move up. So that can actually expand your wage gap. And you do see this trend, I think, playing out, say, in the United Kingdom, where law firms do report their wage gap data. You see it there a lot, too, where the gap is actually growing because you're trying to expand the number of women at this level. So there's a lot. The bottom line is there's lots of explanations. Some of them are reasonable. Some of them are not. But until you have that data, you can't begin to sort through what's reasonable and what's not.
What about the kinds of personal stories that you must have heard while you were reporting this? You know, we've been talking about it so far as a good thing that you can see it as a whole and get a sense of the scale. But you must also hear some really strange and disappointing things when you talk to individuals around this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so I spoke to easily over 50 women, but several dozen who had raised formal complaints against their employer in some way or another. Mm-hmm. And one of the first ones that's detailed in the series is this woman, Gabriella. She works at an engineering firm. She's a trained engineer. She's working as a project manager. And she was put in charge of the budgets of a project. And through that process, she says she learned that her male counterparts, who had been with the company longer, who were actually more junior to her, were making significantly more money than her. And she says she raised this with her employer, and they said, okay, we'll deal with it at your performance review. And when it came time for the performance review, they didn't schedule one with her, and she, raised the issue again, and at this point pointed out this obvious gender problem. And 4 days later, they fired her. Huh. That's kind of an example of the types of things I was hearing. I wrote about a case of a woman who worked for MLSE, Maple Leaf Sports Entertainment, who says that she was fired while she was on maternity leave, and she sued MLSE for wrongful dismissal, and in that statement of claim alleged that this was a systemic problem, that they had done this to other people. I should say that in that case, they had reposted for a job that she says was similar to hers, and she has a text message exchange with her boss about why wasn't she allowed to apply, and he replied that it didn't seem fair given her young family to ask her to work, you know, evenings and weekends.
That's pretty blatant.
Well, this is the kind of stuff that, I mean, when we're talking about the reasons why, you know, our fathers, our young fathers being told that, oh, I didn't think you'd be able to do this job because you have children. So these are the kind of stories we're hearing. And this one story that we wrote about that was just crazy in the amount of documentation there is in it. But it's a woman who alleges that her director, she works for the provincial government, sexually assaulted her. There is a subsequent investigation. There's overwhelming evidence that it occurred. And through the course of that investigation, the investigator uncovers multiple incidents going back a decade against this director that ran the full gamut of, you know, just general sexism to bullying and sexual harassment. And this director, what was really telling was after the investigation found that this behavior was substantiated, he was allowed to resign, citing that his parents were sick. He went and got another job at a municipality in the GTA. And they sent out, the provincial government sent out a memo kind of to staff thanking him and wishing him well. Whereas the woman at the center of this has never recovered from her career, from having it derailed because the events just went on forever. So these are the types of stories that I think at an individual level start to explain this really troubling data that the Power Gap series has shown.
Since you started telling these stories, what's happened? I see you on Twitter publishing secure ways to contact you. Are you getting a lot of that right now?
I do. I have so many emails. If you're listening and you sent me an email and I haven't gotten back to you, I am reading them. I'm trying to just move through them. But I don't think it's a surprise to people that there's gender inequities in the workplace. It's one of those things that just we all know happens. It's what do you do about it? And also, if you're experiencing it, the challenge is, you know, everybody knows it's a problem and it's still happening. So you can feel kind of defeated, right? I think what we're trying to do with this series is get into some specifics, because that's ultimately where things change, like deep diving into specific institutions and really holding individuals to account for why are things not getting better? For example, the provincial government just recently sent out a memo for the first time acknowledging what happened with that employee and the director. And, you know, that might seem like a small step, but it's a really significant one. Canadian law firms, unlike law firms in the US and the UK, have never agreed to release any wage gap data about their partners. And after the Globe story on what's happening at Castles Brock, now 7 of the largest law firms in Canada have said that they are theoretically open to releasing their wage gap data should a professional organization come to collect it. So that's, again, like a small step, but it's really important, because getting those metrics is key. And I think just also places knowing that we're looking at this is important.
What would be a win out of this? I mean, like you just said, small steps, like theoretically agreeing to perhaps provide data if someone asks nicely is great. But, you know, how I guess it seems like such an insurmountable problem when you look at the scope of it, especially given that there are already supposed to be laws governing this. So, you know, how fast and hard can that gap shift, and what can be done to fix it in a reasonable manner? What are you looking for from these companies, I guess, to be more simple?
I think this is partly just biased to my brain that often really works in data, but you need the numbers. Like our project, the data side of it at least, is very limited in what we were able to do. This is just six-figure earners in four sectors in the public sector. That encompasses 90,000 people. It's not insignificant, but it's obviously very limited. It's only capturing, you know, well-off people. You aren't able to take that data and break it down in any way other than by gender. We used first names as an indicator of gender because 90% of names in Canada are associated with a specific gender 95% of the time. Names are not a reliable indicator of race. We were able to capture some data on race with among the 1% of earners because we spent 2 months manually phoning hundreds of people to ask them. But there's no reason we couldn't expand this. The government couldn't expand this. So in the United Kingdom, for example, every company or business or entity that has 250 more employees has to publish wage gap data once a year, and they do it overall, but they also do it in four quartiles of their workforce. And I think just getting those basic markers on the books is step one. Many places also voluntarily go beyond gender disclosure and look at things like LGBTQ plus. They look at ethnicity, at race, at disability, like that you can really see this information. And then I think the other side of it, still on the transparency front, is some measure of accountability around these settlement agreements. You know, I think it's harder to make private businesses disclose that information, but certainly public entities like universities sign a lot of settlement agreements, it seems like. So when I asked these places about this information, very few would speak about it at all. And then the final thing is the Human Rights Tribunal system is just so under-resourced that it's basically ineffective. So either fix it or find some other way to handle these gender discrimination complaints.
That is a long list. I hope to see some of it move.
It's a long list, but it's all very doable, I think. Like, bottom line is, like, you can do all of these things, like, quite easily, especially on the transparency side of data release. Like, just reporting on your gap, on your demographics, that's not that hard. Places already have this information. Just kind of, you know, get it done. Move on.
Put data out to the public? That's not the Canadian way.
It is not the Canadian way, and it's a huge problem. And I think, frankly, it's why progress is so slow in this country on so many different fronts. Because if you don't have those benchmarks, if you have nothing to work with, it's really easy to just ignore the problem.
Robin, thank you for not ignoring the problem. Thank you for walking us through this. And these stories, I guess, will be ongoing in the Globe and Mail for a while if people are interested.
They will be. And thanks so much for having me on to talk about it.
Robin Doolittle of The Globe and Mail. That was The Big Story. For more from us, head to thebigstorypodcast.ca, find us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN, email us anytime, TheBigStoryPodcast, all one word, all lowercase, at rci.rogers.com. Subscribe to this podcast. You can rate us and review us in any podcast player you like. 5 stars only, please. That's what we want to see. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together, and we were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.